like to bring the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Capital Construction Subcommittee, to order. And we've got presentations today, but I think for the moment I'm going to turn it over to my committee staff to kind of give us a preview of what is ahead.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the subcommittee. So we are here today for a public hearing on Senate Bill 5505, the bond authorization bill, specifically to hear the bond-funded requests for higher education. The subcommittee is planning to meet the following two Fridays, May 12th and May 19th, to hear public testimony first on the 12th for Senate Bill 5505 on all general obligation bond requests, and then on May 19th for the lottery bond requests.
Great. So with that, I think we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5505. And up first, we're going to have the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, Ben Cannon. I'm sure you're aware of your time limits.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Yes, Mr. Chair, we are, and we will be brief in our effort to explain for you the process, primarily, that the HEC uses and its role relative to making capital funding recommendations for higher education. We will emphasize that our role is in priority setting. We help to establish recommended priorities for investments in higher education capital in a way that is rigorous, in a way that is driven by principles, in a way that is institutionally agnostic for the most part. And we make these recommendations in the context of our larger budget recommendations for higher education funding, conscious of the debt service implications of new investments in higher education capital. With that, I'll turn it over to our Director for University Budget and Finance, Andrew Rogers, who will describe the work that we've done to bring forward public university requests.
Good afternoon. For the record, Andrew Rogers, Director of University Budget and Finance at the HEC. I'm going to briefly go over some slides specific to the universities, and then we'll see more about community colleges when my colleague Patrick Crane takes over. So we begin with this slide showing the change in debt service from the current LAB to both the current service level and GRB rates. The next slide previews the total debt being requested through the governor's recommended budget. You can see that a total is $349.8 million. About $270 million of that is in state-paid debt authorization. Wanted to briefly show a snapshot of the current university capital portfolio. This slide looks specifically at education in general square footage. These are the buildings and facilities that are used to deliver instruction and related services to students. So the numbers that you see in front of you would not represent something like a residence hall or athletics facility. We can cut that data a few different ways. This slide helps to show the capital footprint of the three large universities relative to the four regional and technical universities. Collectively, Oregon State University, the University of Oregon, and Portland State University hold 80% of that total education in general square footage. The HEC has a statutory responsibility to prioritize capital construction requests from the public universities. And here we show an overview of the process that was used in preparing that prioritization for the 2017-19 biennium. We began with conversations with our commission around the principles that they hope to advance through their prioritization work. That was translated into a scoring rubric, which was applied to specific project requests. At the same time that work was going on, the public universities were actually developing their requests and meeting collectively to really categorize those requests into a number of different tiers. Tier one, or the top tier, representing the most urgent needs on campuses. Those tier one requests were submitted to the HEC in May, and then HEC staff applied the scoring rubric to those requests, ultimately presenting a prioritized list for commission adoption and advanced, and that list was advanced to the governor for consideration in her budget. The principles that I just mentioned are listed on the next few slides. I'm only going to highlight a couple on each slide. The first is in the top left corner. All state-backed debt will support the Commission's strategic plan, primarily through investments in instructional infrastructure, so classroom, laboratory, research, and student services space. The principles and resultant rubric also favors projects that generate operational cost savings, which is an important aspect of our prioritization. Other principles included in our process is an emphasis on public-private and multi-party collaborations. If a project involves collaborations with other sectors of higher ed or other nonprofit or community service departments, that is weighted in our rubric. We also prioritize projects that leverage non-state resources. So the extent to which institution can fundraise or establish institutional resources to support a project ultimately helps it in our prioritization process. The next slide is the rubric itself. And I'm just going to highlight a couple of these categories. You can see near the middle that a significant weight is given to projects that support life safety and code compliance. We also provide campuses an opportunity to prioritize their own lists if they're coming to the HEC with multiple projects. So they can say, we would prefer project A to be prioritized higher than project B, for example. Finally, again, as I mentioned, we do prioritize projects that do have institutional or other resources behind them. I'm going to skip over the next slide, which just summarizes the different Article 11 bond types that universities have access to. The next few slides actually contain the prioritized list that's the result of the HEC work, and which are included in the governor's budget request. I'm not going to go into detail on these projects. You'll hear more about specific projects from the universities today. The number one ranked project in the HEC priority list and also in the governor's budget is system-wide capital repair and renewal dollars. This is omnibus capital funding. It's historically allocated by education and general square footage proportion on each campus. It goes to support needed capital improvements, code compliance, ADA, and safety-related projects. Here we present a history of general fund and state-backed debt for the public universities. You can see at the GRB level, $270 million in state-paid debt is being requested. And finally, this is the last slide that I will speak to today. We present debt service, state-funded debt service history. So this is general fund and lottery fund. There's clearly an upward trajectory as more and more projects have been approved in recent biennia.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Crane. I'm the Director of Community Colleges and Workforce Development with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'll provide a brief overview of the selection and prioritization process for community college capital projects before turning it back to Executive Director Cannon. This slide shows you the state support for public community colleges and debt service. You can see that in the governor's request budget for 2017-18, there's $43.8 million. This slide shows Public Community College new capital infrastructure funding. In the governor's request budget, there are 11 community college capital projects for a total of $75.2 million. The support for university and community college campus safety is not exclusive to community colleges and will be treated separately, and Executive Director Cannon will speak to that. In terms of the overarching rules and principles that guide community college capital, it's important to note a few of them. First, community college capital construction projects are funded by 11G bonds or lottery funds exclusively. They do not have access to the other 11 bonds that the universities do. Second, colleges may not have more than one project approved for 11G bonds that are awaiting match funds at any one time. And then finally, for biennia beginning on or after July 1st, the aggregate amount authorized for the issuance cannot exceed $8 million for a single college project. In terms of the process itself, this is how we went through this in 2016 to prepare the list that you have before you today. Due diligence reports were sent out to the colleges in February of 2016. These templates had 8 overarching categories for the colleges to respond to and a total of 39 separate questions. So each of the colleges prioritized their projects as a tier one or a tier two, responded to the due diligence templates, and sent those back to HEC staff within the Office of Community College and Workforce Development. HEC staff then went through and reviewed all of the projects and essentially tried to mask distinguishing characteristics as much as possible so that we could conduct a blind review based on the merits of each project as they fit within the due diligence templates. A capital construction work group consisted of myself and 4 community college presidents. We each scored the project separately, and then we came together, met, discussed our rankings, and then simply averaged and totaled the rankings to come up with the prioritized list. That list was then taken to the Oregon President's Council for their review and recommendation to the HEC. The Oregon President's Council recommended that Umpqua Community College move to the top of the list. That recommendation, in turn, was taken to HEC's Funding and Achievement Subcommittee. At that point, the HEC reviewed the rankings and recommended them to move forward into the agency request budget and then into the governor's request budget. What you see before you is the 11 projects that are on the governor's request budget in priority order. Again, as you can see from the column, 11G bonds fund requested, regardless of the size of the project, the state match is capped at $8 million. On the final slide, you can see the community college debt service history. Again, similar to the public universities, there's an upward trend. This is a function of simply the number of projects that have been funded over time and the fact that they're ongoing projects still. You'll hear more details about the projects themselves from the community college representatives.
In our final minute, I want to describe the $15 million of lottery bonds that are requested in the higher education budget for community college and university capital projects related to safety. This request came out of a work group, the campus safety work group, that was convened by the governor in the wake of the 2015 tragedy at Umpqua Community College. Membership of that work group included representatives of community colleges and public universities, students, faculty, staff, public safety officials, myself and other agency representatives. You see here the charge and a link to the full report. I want to stress that the recommendations for capital investments related to physical security are a component of a much larger set of recommendations in the report. It's highlighted here in red. It's one piece of one of 5 categories of recommendations that the Campus Safety Work Group brought forward related, obviously, to physical security and infrastructure. This is the sort of drills down on the physical security and infrastructure recommendations that the Campus Safety Work Group made. And here you'll see the language from the report that $15 million be dedicated to develop a physical security grant program that assists community colleges and public universities in funding critical public safety infrastructure, such as access control, cameras, alarms, data storage, mass notification, lighting, et cetera. This is a grant fund that we would be prepared to administer. The work group report and the governor's budget say no more about how that would be administered, but presumably like other grant programs that we and other agencies operate for the institutions that we help to support. And with that, co-chairs, members of the committee, we conclude our report.
Thank you very much. It was exactly on time. I appreciate that. Certainly entertain a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Good to see you all. A couple questions. On the campus safety work group proposal, did you say $15 million in lottery bonds, including these would be projects on the universities as well as the community colleges?
Representative Kokotek, Co-Chair Holby, yes. This is $15 million in lottery bonds that would be made available to projects and requests coming from public institutions of higher education within Oregon, including community colleges and public universities.
Thank you. Can I follow up? So did the HEC ask the universities to consider making these as part of their maintenance ask or any other kind of ask? Because the community colleges and the universities have slightly different bonding authority. So the lottery bonds are pretty scarce. And I know we'd have to use them for the community colleges, but why would we be using them for the universities?
Representative Kotek, Co-Chair Holby, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have a good answer to it, except to say that the recommendation here came from a sort of different source. It came from this separately chartered, if you will, campus safety work group. It came to the governor's budget and to the HEC from that group. And the sort of question of intersection with other bonding types, other requests, was not made, certainly at the HEC level, and was not considered, I believe, by the campus safety work group itself.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Co-Chair Girard, a question
real quick. I was looking at the list that you have here for the community colleges. I know that there was asked from Clatsop and some other ones. I was curious as to why they were left off the list.
Co-Chair Girard, they were included on the agency request budget. It was the governor's decision to cut the list at 11 projects as opposed to the 13 that the agency moved forward.
Okay. Yes, Senator Devlin.
Actually, a request, not a question.
Oh,
if the parties have already provided this to LFO staff, then that's fine. And I'm not requesting that any other speakers from community colleges cover this. But could we get something in writing from the community colleges, either when they intend to go out for a bond measure to provide their match, or whether they're permitted to do this, whether they will be using something other than a bond measure to provide their match?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, a question. I didn't see another one down there.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On the campus security work group, and I apologize if I got the title wrong, can you share with us who served on that committee? I need confidence to know that professionals in campus security management were on that committee. Was the FBI on it? State police?
Representative Smith, Co-Chair Holby, be happy to provide the full membership. It was chaired by Andre LeDuc, who's the, I believe, Chief Resilience Officer. I'm sure University of Oregon will correct me if I'm wrong, but has responsibility for a portfolio that includes campus safety at the University of Oregon. He chaired the work group. It did include other campus safety professionals. It included the superintendent of the state police. And the chief of police for Portland State University, so community college campus safety representatives. So it was a mix of sort of academic and campus safety professionals, and then in Andre's case and perhaps others, folks who had both of those backgrounds in both kind of academic student affairs and campus safety and security.
Just as a quick follow-up, and I appreciate that, and I'm not meaning to take away from their credentials in any way. We had our superintendent of state police. Were there any other folks who have specialized training in these types of management issues.
Representative Smith, Co-Chair Holvey, yes, and we will provide the list.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somebody's going to have to get back with me on these because I don't want to take up hearing time on them. But, Mr. Rogers, you mentioned operational cost savings. I'd like to know more about that. I have a policy bill that deals with student debt this session, and so I'm going to be interested in what goes into the process of determining how the capital asks are going to affect tuition, ultimately affecting student debt in most cases, and also along the lines of deferred maintenance. How is deferred maintenance on existing buildings factored in before we request the funds to build a new building? Because, you know, I've sat here session after session after session and seen mounting deferred maintenance, and yet we keep funding new buildings. And I know that new buildings sparkle and glitter, but at some point I want to make sure that we're getting control of our deferred maintenance. Thank you.
Speaker Kotick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is, I think, a statement for all those who are watching. You know, one of the exercises that I've gone through in the last week is to look at the cost trend in state government. And one of the things that we look at is increasing debt service. So those two charts of increasing debt service for both higher ed and community colleges are part of something we're going to have to look at. And I'm hoping LFO will prepare what the percentage increase over the last couple of biennium has been. Sitting on this committee, we have been funding a lot of new projects. And we are paying the debt. And I can tell you, in our current revenue structure, that is not sustainable. So it's nice that we get recommendations on a list, but we end up paying a long-term debt that I don't think we can afford unless we do something differently here. And so that will be a factor in my decision-making as we determine projects for the upcoming budget. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the comment of reality. And thank you very much to the HEC and especially you, Executive Director Cannon. So with that, we're going to move on to the public universities. I'll call up Rex Fuller, Jimmy Moffitt, and Dan Zalko. Zalkow.
Co-Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Girard, thank you for the opportunity to address the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rex Fuller. I'm the president of Western Oregon University, and I also serve as the co-chair or the chair of the Oregon Council of Presidents. For generations now, Oregon's seven public universities have provided a gateway for the American dream for students and families, and the universities serve as spaces of opportunity for research and for learning. Our success is relied upon the buildings and infrastructure that enable students to learn, our faculty to teach, and our communities to gather. We are stewards for approximately half of Oregon's state-owned capital assets, and we do not take lightly our responsibility to preserve and enhance those facilities. Campuses are both catching up and keeping up as they work to attract the best students. With tuition, revenue, endowments, and capital funding constrained, the age profile of many campuses continues to rise. And so does the risk of deferred maintenance, as was mentioned a moment ago. Today, we'd like to present our collective capital projects request for the 2017-19 biennium that have been proposed by the presidents and have been evaluated by HEC. Today, you'll hear from a panel of three, myself, Jamie Moffitt, Vice President of Finance and Administration, University of Oregon, and Dan Zalko, Associate Vice President for Planning and Construction and Real Estate. We will collectively be presenting all capital projects. But if you have specific requests that we can't answer today, we'll be happy to follow up with more detail concerning any project related to one of the universities. A great deal of data has been provided in this presentation that was collected by Sightlines, a third-party higher education facilities management firm that was contracted in 2016 to study past capital investments and also to talk about deferred maintenance and future demand for our projects going forward.
Terrific. Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Gerard, members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Jamie Moffitt. I'm the Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Oregon. Before we dive into all of the individual requests that we're going to be sharing with you, we wanted to give you some context so that you had some background for the requests that we're going to put forward. And so, as President Fuller mentioned earlier, we did contract with Sightlines, which is a national firm that has deep expertise in terms of buildings and infrastructure, particularly in higher education. And our goal in working with them was to have a third party that could both help us to make sure that when we present numbers to you, that we're presenting them as apples to apples as possible across our campuses, and then also give us access to information about what's going on with other universities across the country so that we can look at those numbers in context. The slide that you're seeing today with this data basically gives you a 10-year look back over the last decade for all seven campuses. We are very appreciative of the investments that we have received. It's been over $1 billion over that time period, again, across all seven campuses, and it's had a tremendous impact on our campuses in terms of the facilities for our students, the facilities for faculty and for staff, and particularly as we've been growing our campuses and having space needs. There have been some real benefits in terms of those investments. We have been able to leverage a lot of that funding, and so you'll see the figure that in addition to the funding we received from the state, we were able to leverage, over $600 million, a large amount from donors and others to match that in terms of the investments that are made. And we've also seen considerable jobs being created through this construction across the state, as you see that figure, just under 14,000 jobs. Over this time period, we've added over 1 million gross square feet of LEED certified space. We've been very cognizant of trying to do things in an energy efficient way, both because it's economical and it makes sense in terms of the operating costs of our facilities and obviously for the impact on the environment. The final bullet point on the side, I think, speaks to a question that came up earlier around taking care of our existing buildings in addition to the needs that we have due to our growing campuses. And so if you look at the money that's been invested over the last decade, over half of it has actually been invested in our existing facilities to try to renovate them and take care of the deferred maintenance type needs that were mentioned earlier. That being said, you're going to see the data that we have to share, which shows that we still have a lot of work to do given the state of our current infrastructure and some of the needs that we have in terms of our student population. Flip the slide. This next slide starts to get into that information. So what it's looking at is it's taking a look at the buildings that are on a campus and what is the age of those facilities, because the age of those facilities, and when I say age, what I mean is what percentage of those facilities have either been built or renovated with a major project in the last 25 years. And the bottom of the charts that you're seeing, the blue bars represent the percent of our facilities that are under that 25-year mark. The top of the bar is the percent that are older. We have about 70% that are older than 25 years, which then has some serious implications in terms of the level of maintenance and repair and deferred maintenance of those facilities. The green line that we've added to this slide is to give you a sense of where peer institutions fall in terms of that metric. And the key kind of point here is that unfortunately our facilities are aging and are older than our peer group. Now you might be thinking, well, what is your peer group? We worked with Sightlines again, which is this national company that has access to a broad base of data on university systems across the country. We asked them to take a look at systems that would be the most like us, and so they looked at their database. They looked for systems that had regional and universities in larger cities that had similar user density, building intensity, and then something they call tech rating, which is basically how mechanically complex are the buildings in the universities. From that list, they came up with seven peers for us. It's the University of Maine, University of Maine System, University System of New Hampshire, Massachusetts State College and University System, Alaska System, Missouri's System, West Virginia's Higher Education Commission, and Pennsylvania's System. So they tried to look at the groups of universities that they thought would be most comparable. So again, key point on this page, which is going to flow into my next one, is just that we are looking at an aging and older infrastructure in terms of our campuses, and then that does have an impact in terms of the deferred maintenance projects. If you flip the page, this next slide is then getting more directly to that question of deferred maintenance. What it's looking at is deferred maintenance needs on the left-hand side that are in our E&G fund building. So as was mentioned earlier with the HEC presentation, we're not talking about auxiliary buildings. We're not talking about housing, athletics, student rec centers. These are all academic core buildings. We're looking at almost $500 million of existing deferred maintenance, and this would be things like roofing, HVAC systems, electrical, lighting, plumbing, those types of issues. The challenge that we have is not only what's existing today, but then again, looking at that life of the buildings that are on campus and projecting forward, well, what's going to be added to that deferred maintenance list as things age. And so what Sightlines did is, on the right-hand side of this slide is a projection where they tried to look at the different ages of the various systems in the buildings and project forward, how would that list be growing. Now, obviously, we're also doing projects to try to take down that list, so I want to be really clear. Our teams are working really hard to try to take care of the most critical issues on our campus. But we do face this challenge that in the coming years, we continue to see a lot of systems and a lot of parts of buildings that are rolling onto that deferred maintenance list in terms of the lifespan of those systems. And then a final page we wanted to share. The other question that we thought was important to point out, again, just thinking about that ENG space, so those core academic buildings, is how does our campus compare, compare to other systems? And again, this is looking at that peer data and saying how much of that ENG space do we have per student? Are we out of line? What this data is showing is that we're actually below the average for all of these different systems. They obviously do vary by system in terms of how much space we have, which I think gets at that question of how you're adding facilities as you're adding students over time. And with that, I'm going to pass it off to my colleague.
Co-Chair Hovey, Co-Chair Gerard, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Zalko, Associate Vice President for Planning, Construction, and Real Estate at Portland State University. We have a couple slides about our internal planning process, and then we'll move on to our project list and go through each project one by one. Now, each of us at the universities has a different process, and it starts with reviewing existing plans. And there's a variety of them. We all have a number of them, such as physical master plans, strategic plans, individual academic school plans, housing strategic plans, and individual academic school plans, climate action plans as well, all of which goes into we review all of them to make sure that we're following and not veering off from any of them unless it's for a deliberate reason. We also have a dynamic environment. Things are changing all the time. Research is constantly changing. The way academic pedagogy is taught and learned is always changing. Recently at PSU, for example, we had a math course that for years has been taught in a 300-seat lecture hall moved to 10 30-seat small rooms where lectures were provided online and group discussions and interactive activities happen in the classroom. So we have to constantly prepare for that changing environment. We also have to look at local and state requirements, 1% for art, bond use requirements. We each have our own local permit zoning and land use requirements as well. And then also the stakeholders. We all have a lot of business partners that we work with. We've got people that contribute to the university for specific purposes. We also work with our local jurisdictions as well. And then lastly, our own initiatives at the time, and most recently some of the ones on the screen, sustainability, accessibility, equity, diversity, have been common themes in the last few years. Next slide. So an example at PSU about what our internal process is before we submit a request to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We start with reviewing those plans and creating a matrix of all our projects. At PSU, at the last round, we had about 30 education in general project ideas that were considered. And we look at whether they will increase retention, recruitment, will they increase research space, will they advance programmatic needs, consolidate units, do they address deferred maintenance, do they provide structural enhancements, accessibility enhancements, et cetera. Then we interview our campus planning department, interviews leadership across the university. And then we come together with a capital advisory committee, which includes our vice presidents, representatives from student government, faculty senate, dean's council, our campus sustainability office. And they spend a few months going through the projects and prioritizing them and then submitting a recommendation to the president and ultimately the board of trustees. So now we'll move back and talk about the project specifically. Rex?
Yes, the next two slides talk about the Tier 1 projects that were identified by the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission's presentation. In beginning in March of 2016, leaders from all the public universities meet to discuss the process of putting forward the projects and coming to agreement on a list that becomes the Tier 1 grouping that is identified here. And to be clear, the presidents chose not to rank the list, but prioritize them in tier one and tier two buckets. But this is a thorough and rigorous process, as has been described by Dan and Jamie. These next two pages talk about the list of projects that sums $284 million, and they are in a grouping rather than priority order. So these are highlighted by the gold outline on the spreadsheet you see before you. Additionally, there are capital projects that are university debt paid, and some campuses choose to put forward the campus-backed debt in F bonds, do not require any state backing. And these are EOU's track and field project, PSU's University Center building, land purchase, and OIT Student Recreation Center. And these are shown on this slide, in addition to the Tier 1 projects shown a moment ago. Going forward, in the shift in the governor's budget, after the HEC submitted its agency request, the governor issued her recommended 2017-19 budget, which included funding for capital projects. There were several projects supported by the presidents that you will hear about today that were not funded in her budget, and they were at Western Oregon University, the Information Technology Center, Phase 3 renovation, at EOU, Loso Hall renovation, Phase 1, at OSU, Fairbanks Hall, a renovation, at Eastern Oregon University, athletics, physical activity, and at Fieldhouse, in three OSU Cascades expansion projects. In addition to defunding of certain projects, the governor's recommended budget also shifted the allocation of types of bonds for certain projects. And while this may seem inconsequential, the types of debt structure have different requirements. Some require university matching funds, and others do not. Thus, a shift in the type of bond could have a real and lasting effect on the institution's ability to carry out and execute the project. We would advocate that all of the changes revert back to the original list put forward by the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. Critical capital improvement and renewal funds for all universities dropped by $19 million. PSU's Graduate School of Education building dropped by $4.5 million, and that was moved from Q bonds to G bonds, corresponding with increases in match. OIT Center for Excellence in Engineering Technology dropped by $2 million, and $4 million was removed from Q bonds to G bonds, corresponding with an increase in the match as well. And finally, the U of O classroom and faculty office building dropped by $11 million. Capital repair and renewal, questions about this thus far, are clearly around priorities that James identified with the Project Sightlines Task Force. This funding provides universities the opportunity to generate operational savings and invest in existing facilities, infrastructure, and reduce the backlog of deferred maintenance. We'll follow some examples.
And now for the projects. First is the Portland State University's Education and Health Building, 4th and Montgomery. This is a collaboration with Portland Community College. They will be moving their dental programs from their Sylvania campus, along with their community clinic for low-income residents, which they're planning to expand. City of Portland has agreed to locate one or more of their bureaus in this building. They have not identified which bureau yet. The new OHSU-PSU Joint School of Public Health will be in this building, as will PSU's Graduate School of Education. For this project, in the governor's recommended budget, the total was reduced from 45 to 40.5, and all in G bonds. Why we would like our request restored is we are struggling to find a path to attain a match beyond $36 million. And then to fully accommodate the Graduate School of Education and the School of Public Health, we need the full $45 million. And to be clear, the $45 million is for the Graduate School of Education and 50% of the OHSU-PSU School of Public Health, with OHSU providing the funds for the remaining half. Right, the next project, Gilkey Hall renovation. This is an OSU project that is turning a over 100-year-old building, the Dairy Science Building, into an academic success center. So two main goals here. One, this project will address almost all, or if not all, of the deferred maintenance in the project, while also providing life safety and accessibility improvements. But it also provides an opportunity to consolidate advising, a writing center, tutoring, and experiential learning in one building. The next project is the Oregon Quality Food and Beverage Center. an $18 million project, 29,000 square foot building. This is a project that will allow OSU to bring forward some pilot facilities in brewing science, wine science, dairy science, and work with various communities to help commercialize the products that are developed at this site. Eastern Oregon's Information Technology Equipment Facility. This is a very small project in dollars, but an extremely important project to the university. It's a $1.2 million project. This will help secure the data center and the networking system in a new facility to avoid the risks that they currently undergoes where the facilities are currently located.
Next slide talks about the project at Oregon State University, the Cordley Hall renovation phase one. This is home to biology, horticulture, botany, plant pathology, and zoology research and teaching. And it substantially improves the students' experiences in all of these core classes. It replaces the mechanical and electrical systems to improve efficiency and savings, also improves safety and accessibility. Next, we have the Oregon Tech Project, the Center for Excellence in Engineering, a Cornett Hall renovation. And it'll complete phase two of this project. It adds capacity to serve 500 additional STEM students in the new high-tech building and completes the renovation of Cornett Hall, increasing the capacity by over a third. It provides a marker space for students in entrepreneurship and interdisciplinary space for applied research with companies. It's focused on growing jobs in rural Oregon. Oregon's high-tech ROI engineering programs are quality programs and graduates fuel the Oregon economy. The next project is at University of Oregon, and it's a faculty office building, was mentioned earlier. It adds approximately 1,700 classroom seats to the campus capacity, as well as 90 new faculty offices to accommodate faculty members currently housed in inadequate space off campus. It also expands critical classroom and office inventory that ensures students can access the classes they need to graduate on time and limit their time in school and also the debt they accumulate. Next project is at Southern Oregon University. It is Central Hall Modernization Plant. It's identified here. It's a 1949 building. It's a building that serves over 1,500 students a week. And this request is primarily for deferred maintenance to address the following: the 60-year-old HVAC system, electrical system, there's a tilted floor on the second floor, a fire alarm system, egress do not currently meet the fire code, so it's a safety issue. And based upon construction design, it would not meet seismic code requirements either. And finally, there are upgrades for current compliance with ADA requirements in the basement, currently partially floods. And this modernization project will fix these maintenance issues. Next project is at Western Oregon University and is the Oregon Military Academy renovation project. And it will allow Western to create a new entrance point for campus. It would be the potential to house student services such as admissions, financial aid, learning, career development, and veterans. The former barracks will also be renovated to allow the university to have innovative admissions visits, conferences, and summer certificate programs for graduate students. The next project is also at Western Oregon University, and it's Information Technology Renovation Phase 3. The primary focus of this project is around seismic and safety issues. And it's the third and final phase after $1.3 million of investment from Western. And again, the focus is on seismic safety and systems concerns, leveraging the previous investments the university has made. At Eastern Oregon University, Loso Hall renovation is a project that is related to the arts. And it identifies a number of activities that include the community. There are venues for outside organizations to meet, as well as regional symphony orchestra, regional choir, and theater groups from throughout the area. It was constructed in the late 1980s, and the facilities have considerable backlog of deferred maintenance, including substantial upgrades to stage, flooring, lighting, audio systems, technology connectivity, accessibility, and seating infrastructure. The next project highlighted is at Oregon State University. It's Fairbanks Hall renovation. It's the second oldest building at Oregon State and is home to the College of Liberal Arts, the highest generator of credit hours at Oregon State. The main focus of this project is to improve teaching and learning spaces, become fully accessible, and to also expand critically needed space on the unused fourth floor.
Great. So I'm going to finish up the list for you with a few more projects. The next project that's up is at Eastern Oregon. It's an athletics, physical activity, and health field house. This project, which has a total cost of $8 million, a state request of $6 million, is endeavoring to provide a facility that apparently doesn't exist anywhere within 300 miles of their campus. And the basic idea is that it would provide a venue that could support not only athletic events, but could also support trade shows and conferences and other activity, which you could imagine would be very helpful for the region, the university, as well as local businesses in terms of the activity. The final two projects that were on the original list of $284 million relate to expansion of the Cascades campus for Oregon State University. And the idea here is really to take the necessary steps to expand that campus so that it can serve enrollment on the eastern side of the state, where we have more students in need that are Pell eligible, rural, and first generation. And this first project, which is a $9 million project, is focused on taking some land that they've already purchased and basically doing the necessary reclamation and preparation work to get it ready so that it could support some of the necessary academic buildings for the new campus. Flip the slide. The next project is also related, as I said before, to Cascades expansion. It is the Graduate and Research Center renovation, again, for Oregon State. This is a $490,000 project. Basically, this was a facility that was purchased in 2012, and at the time, Oregon State did about 60% of the renovation of the building. There's some areas that they believe, with some smaller amount of funding, they could improve to increase the efficiency and utilization of this facility. What we've just run through, and I apologize if it was very quick, was the original list of projects that was on the $284 million list agreed to by all the campuses, and that was our top priority in terms of those projects. We do have a few more that are additional opportunities that we did want to talk about. The first one, if you flip the page, is the UO Science Campus. This is a project, with the help of a generous gift, that the University of Oregon is putting together a new science campus. The request is for $100 million to help in capital with some very critical physical facilities. There are two buildings that would be on the north side of Franklin Avenue. And these buildings would not only house new faculty and labs, but very importantly, would house what are called core facilities, which are basically state-of-the-art instrumentation that can be shared. And so the basic idea is it's instrumentation that would be available not only to researchers, but also to startup companies and the private sector, who might not be able to afford or have access to those types of tools, and could help them with their work in terms of their businesses. If you flip the page, then, we have three more projects that deal with the expansion of the Cascades campus, again, for Oregon State that I mentioned earlier. The first one is a very important campus infrastructure project. It's an $11 million project that would essentially set the stage in terms of roads, parking, utilities, stormwater facilities, et cetera, again, to really lay the foundation so that the campus could be developed. This, I believe, was originally on the governor's recommended budget list as well. The second of the three final Cascades projects is for an academic building. The idea here, this is a total project cost of $49 million with a $39 million request. The idea is this really would allow the expanded enrollment for the campus. It would provide really necessary lab space, classrooms, faculty offices, learning space, et cetera, on site. And then finally, our final project with the Cascades expansion is the Student Success Center. This is a $15 million project with a $10 million ask, and the goal here is to really provide a facility that can provide all the very, very necessary wraparound services for students, advising and counseling and other support that helps them to make sure that they're navigating their time at university well and hopefully to graduation. And with that, we are at the end of our individual list. I think can take any questions that you might have.
We have time for a few quick questions. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. As Speaker Kotecht mentioned earlier, there's been work from a committee in the Capitol called the Cost Containment Committee. And one of the things that committee has been looking at is deferred maintenance. With all these new proposals, what are the university's plans to handle the deferred maintenance on these buildings?
Co-Chair Halvey, Representative Smith. We each have our own approach, so I can only speak to Portland State. The last, you know, the project that we put forward today is new construction. However, the last three major projects were renovations, Neuberger Hall, Peterstadt Center, and school business. So one thing we do is, like you see in this list, many of them are renovation projects. And in those cases, we're able to replace most building systems. The other is with the capital repair and renewal funds that the state provides. For PSU, our latest allocation was $10.8 million. Right now, we've probably got about 20 projects going on just today addressing deferred maintenance on campus. We're replacing plumbing systems, HVAC systems, all across the board. So we are, each of us are constantly, building by building, looking at what we can do, while at the same time looking for opportunities to do a major renovation as well.
And if I could add to that, I think it varies by campus. For example, my campus, Western Oregon University, has some of the oldest structures. And as a result, our projects that you've seen here are for renovation of either a building that is now being acquired by Western, the Oregon Military Academy, or for the ITC building, which used to be the lab school on campus going back to earlier eras and has been renovated to house our technology programs. So it's primarily related to safety, upgrades of technology, but most importantly, seismic.
So, Mr. Chair, just a thought on this. There's not one person on this committee that doesn't support development and higher education in our community colleges. But one of the challenges we have to wrap our arms around is how we're going to collaborate with higher education and the community colleges to manage deferred maintenance. And to me, it would almost appear or seem, as we're looking at slides, we should be seeing not only the cost and the match, but also what are the plans for managing deferred maintenance over the next 20, 30 years on these buildings? Who's going to pick up that cost, and how are we going to maintain that? Just a thought. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to ask some questions for the. You can follow up later because, for interest of time, on the. So thank you for the presentation on deferred maintenance. What I understand is we do a bond, and the campuses all get some percentage of that for deferred maintenance. I'd like to know if there are any campus-based resources going into deferred maintenance. How those are determined, what the percentage is. You know, if we're, you know, for example, if the $10 million you're getting is matched by another. I'm just trying to understand what locally is provided deferred maintenance while we're picking up some of the additional bonding and every campus getting some. So I'm trying to understand that per campus. I'm intrigued by the sight lines assessment that was done, and I'm wondering if that is a mechanism for us to understand how new projects or renovations or any of these projects would affect those numbers around ENG space per student as well as the historical. So if the campuses come to us and say, if we do this project, we get above average, we get better numbers, it's just not totally clear because that was a system-wide number, and I think I'm sure all the campuses are different. And do we have ENG space per student by campus? That would be helpful for me to see. And finally, on the renovation projects, is there any kind of ratio that shows us when we do renovations, you're avoiding some deferred maintenance because you're basically like making a brand new space. Do we ever get those numbers? Like, this building is going to cost me $5 million in deferred maintenance, but for $10 million in this new renovation, we get newer space, plus we're not doing the $5 million for deferred. I'm just trying to understand that, because what I'm hearing from you is those renovations are a good bargain because we're not having to do the deferred maintenance on the older buildings. I think that would be interesting to know how that ratio actually works. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Devlin.
Just for the record, if you connect all the dots in the various documents we have, you can see this. But I would like you to point out one thing, the difference between the request for capital improvement and renewal and what's in the governor's budget. And secondarily, just a statement for the record, if you're a university that's being expected to do G-bonds, you're trying to collect money to match those G-bonds. If you are a regional university where you're expecting Q-bonds, you don't really have an incentive to to save the money for G-bonds, you could actually be doing fundraising for deferred maintenance. It's just a system we've set up. But could you point out the difference between those two numbers? Because I think we see this actually throughout the budget in not just this area, but almost all areas in terms of request for what we would call capital improvement and renewal or deferred maintenance, and what's between the request from the agency and what the governor's budget has. So if you could point that out.
Chair Holby, Senator Devlin, the universities collectively requested $65 million. That is the amount that we received 2 years ago. In the governor's recommended budget, it's between 45 and 46 million. That would result in us going backwards in our ability to address our deferred maintenance. So we do strongly request that the funding be restored to that $65 million level.
Follow up. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair Holby. I have a quick question, and that is, how do we form these lists for deferred maintenance? And is that reviewed by the HEC? And the reason I'm asking for that is the governor slashed from $65 million to $45 million your request for deferred maintenance. I'd like to know what got axed. And so I'd like to know how that's, so we can see, and by doing that, that would show us how the schools are going to, if the money's truly divvied up and how much.
Co-Chair Holby and Senator Girard. At PSU, like in all our schools, we keep a database of our capital improvement needs. At PSU, it's about 600 items, and about $173 million of deferred maintenance is included in that. We do provide the HEC with ideas of what we think we would spend the money on. However, as you all know, with systems that are as old, many of our buildings were built between 1955 and 75. We have so many systems that need replacement or repair, and some of them, we have something that fails almost every month. And so our priorities do change. What we could easily provide is say, what is our latest thinking of how X million would be spent, and what would we do with that much less? And we could also share, what we have done in the past as well. But in our case at PSU, our list gets prioritized every 3 months, and there are changes that happen based on condition.
Thank you. No other questions? I'm curious, a little bit new to this game, but what drives the request to be predominantly, I know the Q-bonds are sort of like free, but when I'm looking at a list, or maybe not free, but not to the state anyway, but what drives a request, because I see many of them have, matching G-bond a request, and some have very little G-bond and almost rely predominantly on Q-bond. So what drives that?
Chair Holby.
Not having a matching bond.
Yeah, Chair Holby, members of the committee, I mean, I think part of what you're seeing is where schools feel like we have a legitimate chance of coming up with those matching dollars, we are trying to do so. And that's generally when you're seeing people put in requests for G-bonds that do require that match in order to access it. There are times, however, where it's very difficult to imagine that we're really going to be able to raise funds, and that's where you would see more of the Q-bond request. Historically, the Q-bond request has also been more associated with the deferred maintenance types projects, and I've only been in my job 5 years, so I don't know historically kind of where that started, but I'm guessing it had a piece to do with the ability to achieve matching bonds in terms of that match. So I think that's largely what's driving the difference between the campuses and the requests.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I think it's the sexy projects get matched, the others do not because they're deferred maintenance, then we pick up the debt.
Yeah.
It's a nice way to put it.
Much better than I did.
All right, well, we'll move on from my educational opportunity. And thank you very much for your presentation. We're going to move on now to the community colleges and have John Wyckoff kick us off with that.
Thank you. co-chairs Hovey and Gerard. For the record, John Wyckoff, Deputy Director of the Oregon Community College Association. I'm going to be very brief and then turn it over to representatives from each of the colleges that have projects up to talk about their individual projects. I just want to make a couple of quick points. One is to remind the committee that in the our last round of funding for capital projects for the community colleges was the 2013-15 biennium, and we were given instructions by the co-chairs to take a pause for a biennium while colleges work to get matches and to bond campaigns and things like that. And so we did not have a request in the last session, and we're coming and then came forward with a full list this session. And as you've heard before, that the line was drawn sort of right above two projects for Clatsop Community College and Treasure Valley Community College were the ones that did that fell below the governor's line. I just want to respond quickly to a couple of the issues that have come up. It is true that campuses often look at other or have to look at other sources of funding to make their match, such as certificates of participation, can be grant-funded donors. I mean, there are many, many different ways to do that, and it isn't always through a bond campaign. Having said that, the match dollars that the state gives can be very critical to helping sort of leverage a local bond to say to your voters, we have money in hand that will be matched if the voters approve this, and it's really important for local voters to know that the state plans to participate in their community. Then the other quick point I would make is you will see, I think as well as with the universities, many of our projects are in fact renovations to buildings that are 35, 40, and you know, and up to 50 years old that are dealing with some very, very serious deferred maintenance safety kinds of needs, as well as just updating them into being modern, relevant educational facilities. But many of these projects are, and you will see that and get an idea of that as our representatives, many presidents from the colleges will talk about their individual projects. And with that, I will conclude so we can let the representatives from the campuses actually talk about the projects before you, as we set up our PowerPoint.
And Mr. Chair and Elfo, do we have information on all 13 projects? I assume we do. I haven't had a chance to look. So they're all online? Okay. Thank you. And I want to say thank you to the community colleges for taking that pause. I think it just gave everybody the opportunity to see if they could actually fund their projects. Yep. And we know not everyone was able to fund their projects. But thank you.
So I think we're starting with Deborah Thatcher. You want to do these one at a time, or John McArdle, and how about Julie Huckasteen?
So, co-chairs and members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee, I'm Deborah Thatcher, president of Umpqua Community College. Thank you for the opportunity to advocate for our project. According to the Oregon Employment Department, there is a growing demand of 25 to 35% in Douglas County and throughout the state for technological preparation in welding, automotive, and manufacturing. Umpqua Community College currently offers successful programs in these areas that lead to multiple certificates and degrees. Our graduates are sought after by local and regional employers. But we are limited in our ability to meet the student demand for our programs and to meet the changing expectations of industry due to our aging facilities, a building that was constructed over 50 years ago. Our instructional spaces are inadequate, outdated, overcrowded, and often require students to work in uncovered outdoor spaces in adverse weather. Our students may be known for their hardiness, but we want more for them. We propose the construction of a new facility, LEED Silver Certified or equivalent, placed on existing campus property that will provide high-tech instructional space that meets industry standards and allows UCC to strengthen employee skills, improve safety practices, boost retention of employees, and enhance students' abilities to successfully secure living wage positions in Douglas County and the state of Oregon. Our proposal is informed by specific feedback from our industry partners. We will be able to add a light-duty diesel curriculum meeting the needs of Chrysler, Ford, and GM partners. Training in alternative fuels and hybrid vehicles can be introduced. Our Toyota partners are excited about our potential ability to produce high-quality graduates at a larger scale to meet the hiring needs of their dealer base. We offer multiple certifications through Snap-on, a partner waiting in the wings to help us with the design and outfitting of the new facility. Likewise, we have strong relationships in the welding industry with Airgas, Miller, and Hobart. One of those partners is poised to provide state-of-the-art equipment for the new building to better educate the employees needed in the workforce. We're currently working with community members to develop a manufacturing technology program that aligns with community needs, with special attention to wood manufacturing. Because automation in manufacturing has increased the needs for engineering, drafting, and computer skills of employees, we're intentionally locating the new industrial technology building next to our existing technology center that houses engineering and computer technology programs. We'll be able to simulate a production facility that overlaps multiple areas of construction. As we proceed with finalizing construction plans and building curriculum, we will enhance alignment of our programs with those of Douglas County High Schools and with needs of community employers, providing students with multiple pathways in education and employment. Current estimates for the cost of construction are around $20 million, and we're asking for $8 million in support from the legislature. Because of consistent philanthropic support in our area, possibilities for grant funding, and expanding relationships with industry partners, we are confident that UCC will raise the funds needed to complete the project. The state commitment, however, will be crucial to our fundraising success. This project is long overdue and will have an incredibly positive impact on our community. We currently instruct 21st century students in a facility that was built in the 1960s. And if you think about the technological changes in the past 50 years, you may understand how our industrial technology programs are constrained by outdated substandard facilities. A new facility that meets industry standards, houses state-of-the-art equipment, provides space to accommodate growing needs, and ensures safety of our students can allow us to fill the needs of increasingly technological industries with highly skilled graduates. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm John McArdle, Director of Development and Government Relations for Lynn Benton Community College. And LBCC is passionate about its commitment to meet the workforce needs of our region. Our industry partners tell us they have 1,000 jobs to fill in the coming 5 years with family wage technical positions. To meet the needs, we're expanding and upgrading our career technical, our CTE offerings in machine tools, welding, non-destructive testing, and advanced manufacturing, also known as mechatronics, by upgrading the facilities on our Albany campus to meet the workforce needs of the Mid-Willamette Valley. So we can help people get the jobs that they need while providing business with the workers they require. We're asking you to continue the state's partnership with the college, industry, local government, and voters in our area. The voters in Lynn and Benton County have shown their support for our efforts through the approval of a general obligation bond, which will provide the matching funds for these projects. We have the money in hand. In addition, the City of Albany is providing $2.9 million for equipment for these CTE programs and local industries coming together to assist with additional equipment. In addition to meeting workforce needs, we are assisting students in moving strongly towards completion and will renovate facilities for student advising and services to individuals with disabilities, which is one of our larger, which is one of the groups that's increasing at the fastest rate on campus. And in addition to increasing public safety measures on our Albany campus. We seek your help with $7.5 million to meet the workforce needs of industry and support students and families as they reach for career success. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Garrod. For the record, my name is Julie Huckestein, President of Chemeketa Community College. The Chemeketa Agricultural Complex will be located on the Salem campus off of Lancaster Drive. The project cost ranges from $12 million to $17 million, depending on the number of community partners who choose to co-locate and the ultimate scope of the project. Our request from the state is $6 million. For a number of years, the Chemeketa Community Board, faculty, and administration have been interested in expanding our agriculture and horticulture programs. We're excited to bring this project forward and look forward to the opportunities it will bring to our community. As you know, agriculture is crucial to Oregon's economy. Marion County alone brings in over $600 million in annual gross cash income from agricultural production. Oregon State University estimates agriculture, food, and fiber industry brings in over $50 billion in economic activity into our state. This agricultural complex will expand the Chemeketa agriculture and horticulture programs and facilities and allow collaboration with other partners in the Willamette Valley, including OSU Extension, Marion Poke Food Share, and hopefully Marion County Soil and Water Conservation District. These are partners that we have already had conversations with and are supportive of this project. We have also shared these project hopes with the local community through advisory committees, the Oregon Association of Nurseries, the OSU Master Gardeners, local high schools, and we've received overwhelming support. We already have strong partnerships with OSU Extension and Mary Pope Food Share and share a faculty position with Oregon State University. This project has significant similarities to our wine studies program that's located in West Salem. It already has a strong collaboration in Oregon with vintners and winemakers. Currently, our agriculture and horticulture programs are housed in three modular buildings on the Salem campus, four hoop house growing structures, and several sheds and indoor and outdoor laboratory environments. When I think about this, I think about how you visualize these different types of buildings. The Marion Polk Food Share Youth Farm is already located on our property. Youth from the district work along students in our agriculture program and learn to grow vegetables on a five-acre plot. This 30,000 to 40,000 square foot project will replace the modular classroom buildings, allow us to replace some equipment and a pieced together greenhouse, and also allow for partner space as well. Having partners will allow us to leverage our resources and share space, add to operational efficiency and services to the community, and hopefully our end result is to save taxpayers money. Our vision is to provide a location where students and community members can come to one location to receive educational programs and services related to agriculture and horticulture. Current programs that we have are the agribusiness management, so we work with the farmers, whether small or large, and to try to work towards planning for the future. The agriculture transfer degrees with Oregon State University, and we have a horticulture program. This investment will allow us to meet critical workforce needs in the agriculture sector. The industry is changing both technology and best practices for viable small farms, especially with emerging farm-to-table trend. We look forward to future possibilities with this complex and what it will bring to our communities. Thank you for your interest.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Appreciate that. Up next, Lisa Avery, Brett Roulette, and Patty Scott.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Gerard, and committee members. My name is Lisa Avery. For the record, I am the campus president at Portland Community College, Sylvania, and I am here today to request funding for the HT, our health technology building, and a capital request. We're asking $8 million, and I wanted to briefly amend my remarks to respond to Senator Devlin's question. This is part of a match, which we are going out for a bond. The other $22 million would be approved, hopefully, by the voters in fall of 2017. The rest of that bond, interestingly, reflecting on this current conversation you've been having, is deferred maintenance for the rest of the PCC district. HT is our oldest and largest building. It is now approaching 50 years old, older than many of our students and older than a lot of the faculty as well. And as happens with age, it is experiencing some deterioration. It's a centerpiece of our educational opportunities, but given the need to improve the HVAC, the roof, our ADA requirements, our energy usage, HT is the biggest energy consumer in the PCC district, largely because of the dated HVAC, so we are seeking to improve that and be able to be much more responsible with our energy use. In HT, we have healthcare and healthcare technology programs, our nursing, fitness technology, biology, radiology, and radiology tech programs, environmental science, anatomy, and physiology. Those all have new and updated laboratory requirements, high-tech equipment that we hope to house in a new and updated infrastructure. And these are very, as you might know, I'm sure you do, great job growth fields for us right now, particularly in Portland with a number of people moving into the area needing health care. These are great jobs for our students at family wage levels when they graduate. Many of the programs are full with wait lists, so we see this as a wonderful opportunity for us to further our mission of rebuilding Portland's middle class and helping advance equitable student success. Thank you for your consideration of this request.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Brett Rillette, Director of Public Affairs at Lane Community College. Thank you for this opportunity to speak this afternoon. Lane Community College's Healthcare Village is the culmination of campus and community-wide efforts to coordinate and strengthen education programs across health professions. The proposed building addresses academic and operational needs of various healthcare programs to ensure the communities of Lane County continue to have a strong pipeline and workforce for health professions. Lane Community College has made strategic investments to expand and improve healthcare training. This effort began in 2010 with the opening of a new health and wellness building to expand cohorts and improve educational experience for students in nursing, physical therapy assistants, respiratory care, and EMT programs. The Healthcare Village represents the second phase, addressing specific needs in Lane's dental hygiene, dental assistant, dental therapy, a proposed program, and medical assistant programs. At present, the healthcare professions programs associated with this project are widely distributed across campus and across the city of Eugene. This lack of collection has resulted in multiple barriers in the daily activities of students and faculty, creating a lack of programmatic cohesion. For example, the dental clinic is located 5 miles off the main campus, a distance that creates difficulties for students and faculty as they must travel from the classroom lectures and office space on campus to the clinic for their clinical experiences. With the introduction of new technology in the health fields, there's also come an increased demand for program space. The new facility will not only address these needs, it will allow for additional academic enhancements such as a dental simulation lab, a medical assisting lab, and increased online educational options to disseminate instructional components to rural areas throughout the state. We estimate the total cost of this 24,000 square foot facility to be $16.2 million. We expect the local match to come from a combination of fundraising, a future bond, and new market tax credits. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Patty Scott. I'm the president at Southwestern Oregon Community College. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to ask for capital construction during this legislative session. Southwestern Oregon started in 1961 in Army barracks near the airport. While the campus administration and the Board of Education looked for a permanent location and build the original campus, the operation moved in around 1965 to its current location with four original buildings that were designed at the time to add a second floor onto them. So our capital request this session is to take one of those buildings, Delwood Hall, and add a second floor to this building. And this building currently serves as part of our student services building, student services location. As you can imagine, in the mid and early 1960s, students coming to college campuses demanded and asked different services of campus employees than they do today. Our safety and security needs were non-existent in the early 1960s. We didn't have any idea what an active shooter or any of those kind of things that we would learn, fortunately, about many years later. We also had about 500 students accessing our campus. Today we have over 10,000. So this request would renovate the building at about 12,000 square feet and allow us to consolidate all of our student services into one location, which would increase student satisfaction and completion because they will be able to access everything that they need in one location. It will also create additional efficiencies with the staff so that they can collaborate and help the students more efficiently because they're all co-located in the same building. And at the same time, we'll deal with all the deferred maintenance issues, technology demands that we struggle to keep up with. This renovation cost is about $5.5 million, so we're asking for about $2.7 million. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Seeing any, thank you very much. Up next, Joanne Truesdale, Deborah Durr, and Camille Priest.
Good afternoon.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanne Truesdell. I'm president of Clackamas Community College. I want to talk with you about the Desjardins-Pauling Science Complex. Essentially, what we're proposing to do is to add 20,000 square feet of new lab space to an existing facility, capitalizing on its existing elevator HVAC system, and then renovating a 35-year-old science lab of 40,000 square feet. This project is 24 million total. We currently have secured over 12 million in match funds. We're asking for 8 million from the state. Why is this important? Right now we have one chemistry lab. Chemistry is the launch point for a number of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. As a non-science major, my faculty, who are a lot smarter than I am in this area, say if you grow it, eat it, treat it, drink it, build it, or design it, this is the facility and this is the lab you go through first. We're currently 250 students who are off track, and that's because right now we are full up. The lab operates from morning until evening time, 6 days a week. One day we take off in order to clean it thoroughly. Students are not able to start a sequence at varying terms for a multiple number of projects. We cannot stop and renovate one lab. If we do, we take our sciences off track for an entire year. We have a local, not only did our taxpayers help support through a bond, but we also have local and regional partners who have put money into this facility and who are willing to keep money into this facility. Our long-term maintenance and deferred maintenance, so thank you for that question, is about creating another public partnership and private partnership where we actually have people who are coming in renting lab space in order to do their work that they launch off into the urban agriculture area. There are a number of byproducts that are available to make in our industry areas in agriculture, such as berries into jam. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has a number of cooperative and individual businesses that you can actually apply for grants. They just need some space to test whether or not their facilities, and we believe that that's the next place where we go. We were approached 2 years ago to determine if we could do that, and we're still exploring it, but it's dependent upon the facility. Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Durr, and I am president of Mount Hood Community College. And for those of you who are not familiar with Mount Hood, we serve a community, a district that reaches from I-205 in East Portland to Cascade Locks, from the Columbia River through Gresham, up through Sandy, to Hoodland and to Government Camp. Our college, as many of our colleges, have celebrated its 50th anniversary last year. And as the vision for that college was 50-some years ago, our buildings were built to serve approximately 10,000 students, and now we regularly serve over 28,000 students. On the west side of our district, Maywood Park, Park Rose, and Gateway serve communities living in the greatest poverty in our state. Our Maywood Park Center was built in 1928 as a Catholic elementary school. It is now a community center for both learning and coming together. It is diverse, vibrant, and terribly out of date. The campus has an HVAC system that is failing. The ability to upgrade and provide technology to our students is minimized due to that structure. And the structure itself, from our engineers, have told us that it is failing. Our capital project proposal will assist us to address the growing needs of these communities, who, as we went out and talked with them, gave us three priorities. The first was housing, the second was safe communities, and the third, which was actually the most important to them, was jobs where they could support their families. The Maywood Park Center is a center that works with these populations of people. It is the center where we provide adult basic skills, where our IBEST programs are located, where our career pathway programs are located, and we have very, very strong both community and business partners that work with us in relationship to those programming. We will accomplish those goals through the partnerships that we have in that area. The college must come to the table with resources to provide us with the leverage for those partnerships. Our goal is to have a third of our project paid for through a capital campaign, a third through grants and private partnerships, and a third through the state. Without the funds from the state, our ability to serve those people and to leverage those partnerships is definitely minimized. So I thank you for the time and hope that you will support all community colleges capital.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Cam Preuss. I'm president at Blue Mountain Community College. Thank you for the opportunity, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak about our proposed capital construction project. BMCC has been working in collaboration with the City of Pendleton and the Pendleton Roundup to design and construct a state-of-the-art facility that would provide our students with hands-on learning environment and augment our classroom instruction. BMCC is one of only a very few colleges in the Northwest that actually has a working farm where we have livestock and the students are responsible for the livestock, their nutrition and their care. And agriculture, we have crops, they're in charge of planting, harvesting, precision irrigation, you name it, and they also do the sales and business end. It is a real hands-on teaching and learning environment. The facility that as proposed will enhance and expand upon BMCC's nationally recognized agriculture program. It is our largest enrolled career and technical program on the campus of animal science, agriculture, and livestock, giving students across the Eastern Oregon region an opportunity to build their skill and attain well-paying jobs. It would be a facility that could host numerous workshops, clinics, and events related to agriculture and livestock and be the home for BMCC's national championship rodeo team. I have to say that. The project, while primarily educational in purpose, would help boost tourism and the economic vitality of Eastern Oregon and the city of Pendleton. The three major partners, the college, the city, and the Roundup Association, are seeking the $5 million match for this project, and we have already formed a fundraising committee and have a pledge from two public institutions at about $300,000, so we're on our way. And we would construct this project on land that is owned by the city of Pendleton, but is actually part of the Roundup. So thank you for your consideration for the project.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and your presentation. Up next, Bridget Reisling and Ron Fox. I know I got the Ron Fox right. I'm not sure.
Thank you, co-chairs Holby and Sherrod. It's, for the record, I am Brigida Reisling, and I am the president of Oregon Coast Community College in Lincoln County, Oregon. And the facility that I'm here to talk about, we have loosely titled the Workforce Education Resiliency Center. Oregon Coast is a little bit different from some of the other colleges in terms of the age of our facilities. We are turning 30 this year, and it's only the last 10 years that we have had, or a little less than 10, that we've actually had our own facilities in a campus. And so prior to that, we were in rental facilities all around Lincoln County, including the a bar and a mortuary. So, you know, you work with what you have on the coast. So we have these wonderful facilities. They're relatively young, and they're excellently constructed in terms of the capacity for our transfer students and also our small business, which is very important to the economy on the Oregon coast. But where we are lacking and where there's a mismatch is between the workforce needs of Lincoln County and the facilities that we have. So we have two good, great, wonderful career technical programs. Nursing, we've graduated 150 nurses since we we started that program, each one earning $50,000 a year. That's an excellent living wage, family wage job on the coast. And we also have an aquarium science program. But where the needs are, the additional needs on the coast there, ever since I arrived a couple of years ago working with industry, and there's a variety of types of workforce jobs on the coast that are going unfilled. These are good paying jobs, and our employers are looking for those. And we have, as many of the rural communities, our income level or educational achievement is certainly well below the state average. So the idea behind this project is to add capacity to do those workforce kinds of programs. It would be on existing land adjacent to our Newport campus. We have numerous partners from industry, the ports, the boatyards. We're working with the Maritime Solutions Group. We are looking forward to the data that will come forth about the workforce needs in maritime. We're partnering with Clatsop Community College so that we can complement and supplement each other's programming. And have plans to, as you see there, in a variety of funding sources to do the match. We feel very good about that, and I will end there, and thank you very much for the support.
Co-chairs Hovey and Gerard and members of the committee, maybe I am the unique last one here for more than one reason. I am, for the record, I am Ron Fox. I am a board member for Rogue Community College and the current chair of our board. Our president, Kathy Kemper-Pell, was unable to be here to speak to you today. She has a campus-wide meeting with staff and faculty. Just a little bit of background on Rogue Community College. You know, Rogue began as a rural community college in Josephine County in 1970. And then in 1996, Jackson County, the last remaining metropolitan area in Oregon without a community college base, joined the Rogue Community College. And so now we are a metropolitan community college covering all of Josephine and Jackson County. So we are a college that has been under a tremendous amount of growth in that period of time. I would also mention, sort of in reference to Representative Kotek's comment, during that hiatus we took from requesting capital funds, Rogue Community College was successful in a voter-approved $20 million bond measure. And that bond measure is being spent as we sit here today to improve our campus facilities, both the campuses in Grants Pass and the two campus facilities essentially in Josephine and Jackson County. And we have, and for this particular ask this year, we have that our match in hand for this one. Projects that we are approaching for $8 million include a renovation of our science building on the Redwood campus in Josephine County. This is a building built 40 years ago. The structure of this building is essentially a laboratory classroom in which all of the classrooms are sort of built in a round with no closure for the lab, so they all face a common center. It's almost impossible for us to manage the hoods and other air management responsibilities that exist in this teaching facility. There's issues of fire safety and noise and sort of fumes are a major problem. This supports almost all of our science and technology curriculum, including our healthcare programs. And so this is a gateway project that is needed to support the expansion of our students in nursing, science, and other practicums that require a science portion of the curriculum. The second portion of the request is a renovation of our nursing building, again at the Rogue, Redwood campus in Josephine County. It's a nursing building. This building is 50 years old. If you follow the history of Rogue Community College, you might remember that its campus in Josephine County was a former Job Corps campus. Many, many years ago. This building is our number one healthcare training and education facility. 12 of our allied health programs, including phlebotomy, medical coding, and medical assistance training, all center on that campus. And they say it's in it. And currently in our region, the Asante Medical System, it's our major hospital system with three facilities in the two-county area, has over 900 vacant positions requiring mental or health training. And I know from a presentation I made, 150 of those are registered nurse positions that they're attempting to fill but unable to meet. Our project will also give you a return on your investment in our We had 29 graduating nurses in 2016. Those nurses are in the workforce primarily in our region and earning $1.6 million in new wages, which is doing their part to support your revenue stream. We appreciate your consideration of our projects and all the other projects before you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, that concludes the community college presentation. We had set some time for public testimony. No one has signed up for public testimony. Didn't know if there was anyone left that wanted to provide public testimony. Not seeing any. Speaker Kotek.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I just want to say thank you to all the presidents and board members and all the folks who came for the presentations. I know you have things to do back home, so appreciate the some of you traveled quite far to come here, so thank you very much. I'm wondering if LFO can prepare for us. I know I always take quick notes on who has money now, who's got bonds coming up, who doesn't know quite sure where they're coming from, who didn't get their project funded last time. I think it's just context. I mean, I think, you know, the pause has really helped us, you know, manage our obligations here, and there's some really good projects here. So appreciate all the time you've put into it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator, President Cortez.
Yeah, I asked for a reading on what HEC asked for, what Governor asked for, the President's Council. And I don't know if there's another category of the different for higher ed, and I prepared that. And you might have that distributed, too, among the members, if you would. I find that interesting. I do think it's interesting, and while this is not comparable at all, 11 of the 17 community colleges have put their request in today for about 75.2. And I'll just leave that there. If you look at the amounts listed by HEC, by the governor and or the president's council, you know, I just leave it there for what it's worth. For just it doesn't matter. It doesn't compare, but I find it interesting.
All right.
I'm looking very hard at you. I just think it's
fascinating. I'm thinking. Thank you, Mr. President.
Let us. Co-Chair Girard, any comments?
All
right. Amanda, do we have anything else left?
No, we
for
will.
For business?
What's next week again?
We're going will to see you next week, same time, same place. We are scheduled to have another public hearing on Senate Bill 5505. It'll be exclusively public testimony.
On general fund bond returns.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I will adjourn the Subcommittee on Capital Construction of the Joint Committee of Ways and Means.
I've already shown my card.
Of the Joint Committee of Ways and Means.
I've already shown my card.
Capital Construction.